I don't mind talking about my pineal gland if it comes up.
Okay. Oh, pineal glands are coming up on this podcast episode, Glenn, and all that.
The truth is that, you know, they trepanated my cheek in order to allow for this area.
For folks who aren't watching, because this isn't a video recording, Rachel Kushner is pointing to her third eye, to her pineal gland. We're talking about the ontology of medical mishaps. You were talking about how it feels like a personal failure sometimes to have some sort of medical condition. This is how I feel about the back, my back. This is how I feel about my giant honking tonsils. I went to the ear, nose, and throat doctor a couple of weeks ago, and she's like, let's just go have a look in there. And I open my mouth and she goes, whoa, those are some honking tonsils. And they're going to take them right out, which is awesome. Like, I didn't think they did that. Yeah, I'm going to get them removed. It's been causing me all like sleep apnea and stuff like that. And she's like, you know, you really should have got these taken out 20 something years ago. And then I felt badly about myself. I said, what is it about me that like I've lived with this condition for so long and I never really did anything about it? What does that say about me as a person? And the doctor was a brassy old woman. And she's just like, we're just going to chop them right out. You'll be fine. Bah, bah, bah. You move on with the rest of your life.
So. Well, the back is often a personal thing. And if you've ever read Dr. Sarno, I highly recommend it. He talks about the sort of mental causes of back pain.
So I got some bad juju in my brain, which is why my back hurts.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right.
I thought you were mentioning the name of like some obscure literature I should have read, and I'm so relieved. It simply sounds like
he's just a chiropractor.
Look for people who
yeah. It's a chiropractor self-help book, but it's very good.
Andy is just recommending a crank for all of us to read, which is nice. I mean, chiropractic is kind of a crank science. So,
well, I mean, it sounds like you're moving on to a Philip K. Dick phase with this third eye stuff. So that might be the right time for you to become a crank.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. But to go back to like and then forward into more, pressing, if there is pressing subject matter vis-a-vis the occasion, for me to claim the right to appear on the vaunted Antifada. But to back up, I think, you know, when you have physical suffering, at least for me, there's a way in which it seems like it has something to do with me, like mm-hmm. the very spiritual tissue of my existence, in a way that makes it already a non-literal experience and rather a metaphorical experience. Like, oh yeah, this would happen to me. And I think it comes from childhood. And if I may be so bold as to generalize, the way in which you have unmediated experiences with the world that don't have to do with the more protected symbolic universe of your family that starts early, you know, and that's like these are direct encounters. And then I feel like the person sort of shapes themselves out of a semblance of those encounters. And so negative feedback is like part of personhood or something. I don't know, it's hard to explain. Anyway, as I had been telling you, I had to have this like unscheduled oral surgery to the inside of my cheek when we were supposed to do this podcast, and the doctor who removed this mask said it looked like an eye, and I just immediately thought, let the true third eye finally descend now that the ersatz and false third eye embedded itself in my cheek has failed in its attempt to make its home there.
Yeah.
And impede.
Represents a blockage.
To impede my inner vision by facing my eye inward into the mouth.
And you know, if that doesn't work, there's always trepanning. That's a surefire opening up the third eye.
Yeah, I mean, so I never got into that kind of stuff. But as soon as you say that word, I can picture standing in, you guys are probably too young to remember this place, St. Mark's Books. Benjamin Friedman, who runs Topos Books now, you guys probably know him.
Yep. He's right down the street. I can wave to him from here. Hey, Benjamin.
He is from my neighborhood in the Inner Sunset in San Francisco. And
oh, cool.
He would be like working at St. Mark's on a Friday night, and I would go in there to browse because they were open till midnight. And I remember seeing that journal. There's this journal called Amok.
Amok.
And then, you know, it was part of this, like, I don't know, like 90s future primitive weird thing. Not my deal at all. But that was where I was exposed to the concept of trepanation.
And that is what you're opening a hole in your skull and allowing, like, your, am I right about that? What is it, Andy?
Yeah, it's drilling a hole where your third eye should be, right?
Oh, mm-hmm. Gotcha. And because your skull is impeding.
Yeah, right? Theoretically, it lets your brain kind of go out of the cranium a bit and it expands its dynamism in some way. And you can you can get it done in Mexico. There's places you can legally or semi-legally get it done.
A country of freedom.
There may be some original tribal custom or ritual of this, but for people who don't come from that culture, those cultures, to get this done, I would say it's almost the exact inverse of what I was trying to describe with my impoverished native intelligence or my intuition about what illness and pain is. I think that one automatically makes it into a metaphor, whereas the trepanation is literalizing something that should remain figurative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. I have a way to maybe segue us into talking about the book.
Well, let's let me just introduce the guest if we can.
Please do.
We're talking to Rachel Kushner, author of the novels Flamethrowers, Telex from Cuba, The Mars Room, and others, and now just released yesterday, Creation Lake. And she is one of my favorite writers, so very exciting to have you here. How are you doing? How are you feeling about the book hitting the shelves?
Thanks, Andy. Thanks, Sean. Pleasure and honor to be here. You know, it's abstract because writing this book was so fun for me. It was maybe the most fun I've ever had doing anything. And then you write the book and then suddenly you have to come up with some technique or manner of talking about the book. Like, the book itself is the thing to write. And then suddenly you have to produce surplus words to find a way to discuss it. But, you know, there can be some use to that in terms of, like, moving beyond yourself and having hindsight and seeing things in a new way. So that's happened to some degree. In terms of the reception, like, it kind of seems like people are curious to read it, which is very lucky and makes me feel good. I didn't necessarily anticipate that communes and Neanderthals would be like a commercial winner, which isn't to say that it will be. And it's not clear how much that matters to me anyhow.
Getting an advanced copy of the book is always an honor. That's a thing I call podcaster's privilege. Normally, these are like weighty tomes, like nonfiction texts that, like, we manage to reach out to different publishers and they send them to us and we get to read about, I don't know, like the history of the AFL-CIA and all sorts of like stuff like that. But this landed, this crossed my transom, and I have to say I was pleasantly surprised, perhaps I shouldn't have been, to find out it's a great fucking book. Like, it's really, really good. So thank you for writing it, and thank you for using this piece of fiction, bringing us and all of the readers of this, because I can't imagine it's not going to be a success, into a very particular world, into a very particular space. If there was going to be a segue I had, it was going to be about Andy and I going to the East Village, which, with your reference of St. Mark's books, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with that, the Alphabet City area, and having the shock of unrecognition of having not been there on like a weekend night, a weekday night where everybody's partying, going to Rax King's birthday party at karaoke, and experiencing a part of New York City, a part of the world that has a deep and long history of characters like Ben Maria and Up Against the Wall Motherfucker, all sorts of various leftist and subcultural squatting groups that existed, arts groups, obviously, on the edges and the fringes, from CBGBs to the Continental or whatever, and arriving there in the year of our Lord 2024 and not recognizing it, and in a sense not recognizing yourself, because it's a space that's changed. It's a feeling that's changed. It's a vibe that's changed. It's a political economy that's changed. So I'm not going to talk about how I was on day 11 of like a crazy overtime binge of like working to try to finish this crazy big job and really, really tired and upset, but ready to go out, wanting to fight various people on Avenue B. I won't go into that entire thing. I will say that we had fun. And I'll also say that there's something about this book that really draws you into like a milieu that Andy and I have had the fortune of passing through around the time that this book has taken place, and a milieu that you really do justice for. And I'm not saying that like Zoe Heller's The Believers, which is a book that I read through Racks a couple of years ago, doesn't do justice to a particular sort of new left New York City sort of familial vibe. But I think you imbue like a deep respect with the material and take seriously this like left milieu of France in a particular time and place that needs commemoration, needs analysis, needs fictionalizing. And I think you do a wonderful job with it.
Thank you so much, Sean. Many things.
I threw a lot at you there.
Yeah, many things I could say. I'll start with the East Village and then I'll go back to the book and the milieu of France. And as I, quoting famously others, put it yesterday, you know, I'll speak about the passage of a few people through a rather brief moment in time. It's funny you mentioned Avenue B, and I used to live in on the Lower East Side on Norfolk Street. I've lived in the East Village, but before that, as a teenager, I would come to New York City to visit my cousins who grew up in the city, and my cousin Tovey had a storefront on Avenue B. He's an artist and a blacksmith and a farmer. He left the city pretty long time ago at this point, but he used to go between upstate where he was farming and his storefront on Avenue B. Before he started farming, he just had the storefront, and he was involved in this kind of collective on the Lower East Side called the Rivington School. I don't know if you guys know about that history. But they were mostly metal workers who occupied abandoned lots in the East Village and on the Lower East Side. And they had a place on 2nd and B, 2B, it was called, or the gas station.
I remember that. Yeah,
you do?
I do remember
it. Yeah, it was an old gas station, and they made a perimeter around it that was just all like junk, like old bicycles and things welded up onto the cyclone fencing.
I know about that because that's where Gigi Allen played his last show. And there's some amazing footage of it.
I didn't know that. I used to go to shows there as a teenager because my cousin had his blacksmithing operation was inside of 2B, which is kind of amazing. I mean, it's probably illegal to run a forge in New York City because, like, you know, you're burning coal. I mean, he'd buy these trucks from the Port Authority that have heavy duty springs in the back because he's going to Pennsylvania to get coal, you know, and then like they're burning it in a forge on the Lower East Side. And there were a lot of people who were just there to hang out, and it did have kind of darker, more druggy elements to it. I remember seeing the Luna Chicks there and then them mm-hmm. having a fire, people sitting around the fire. And I was probably 15 or 16, and it's like everybody kind of seemed a little zombie-ish. Not at all my cousin, though. You know, it was like he was about actively doing and making art. He and this guy Parker and a guy named Cowboy Ray Kelly, who was a sort of is or still around. I haven't seen him in a long time. These were kind of like personalities on the Lower East Side. And they would all hang out on the sidewalk in front of Tovey's storefront on Avenue B. And when he started farming, he was farming on somebody else's land, a Taiwanese artist named Shuli Chang, who kind of like made some money in the porn industry in Taiwan and used it to buy this land upstate in Andes. And the house on the land was called Rotten House. Mm-hmm. And the description was accurate. I used to stay there. Tovey would bring down vegetables and then have these like salad happenings, juice happenings on Avenue B. And he would like mount a juicer on the back of his truck and make juice for everybody. And he would just be like chasing after all of the denizens, like a lot of unhoused people around there trying to feed them salad. And it was just, you know, it was a different time. But yeah. The thing about nostalgia is like, I just, I'm not sure what role it plays. And if you ask Tovey now about like the Rivington School, because there are people who've had photo shows about it and tried to sort of like recapture or just celebrate this era that whose traces are no longer to be found in the city itself, he wants no part. It's about now and tomorrow. It's always about what I'm doing now for him and never about kind of like wearing the past as, you know, authenticity wrist bracelets or something.
Right.
No interest in that. And that is kind of useful for me sometimes. Just it's like the true maybe, how do I put this? I think responsibility, if there is responsibility, lies in locating what's interesting now. And seeing that is not always easy. Mm-hmm. Look around and like we can look at moments of the past and they seem charged, like they have an electrical charge to us. At least, I'm sorry to generalize, I should say I do. But what of my own time has that same charge? Yeah. Or rather, what am I able to see in my own time that has that charge?
I think this expresses really well what I so consistently like about your work is you are often, in Flamethrowers and Creation Lake at least, you're looking at these moments in the past, describing, I think, through your eyes or with your voice at least, your three eyes, like what it must have felt like. Flamethrowers particularly, like the idea of seeing New York City in the late 70s with your voice and with your perspective, the same way that I imagine you were seeing New York City when you were writing the book and trying to understand the continuity, what's changed, and, you know, looking at those characters the way you probably see the characters in your life. So, like, for example, there's a character in Flamethrowers who's similar to Ben Maria, who we've had on the show. Mm-hmm. In Mars Room, there's a motif of talking about Ted Kaczynski. And now in Creation Lake, which takes place in 2013, we meet characters who resemble the French post-left milieus, like the so-called cocoonists of France, as they prepare to confront a megabasin project. So why are you so consistently drawn to portraying revolutionary groups like these in your work?
I'm not sure. I'm drawn maybe to try to form some synthetic parallel world. It's imagined, but is furnished with features and elements of my own world and the one I've lived in, or that shaped and came before the one I inherited. And it's not like I'm sifting through a bunch of material and choose this over other things. I guess I'm a product of my own environment. And in terms of like the New York City that I portrayed in the Flamethrowers, since you mentioned it, I was thinking it's like, it's different things, different veils and guises and different strains of reality kind of confected together. And I lived, on Mulberry Street in Little Italy in 1980, just for a summer. But, you know, when you're 11, one summer is a significant section or segment of your reality. Okay. And also it came at a time when you're 11, I'm suddenly, I think kids are like, they're fully formed people, like the things you think back on that you observed and noticed when you were six, you're still that same person. But when you're 11, you're looking at the adult world in a much more unmediated way all of a sudden. You know, I was wearing full makeup at 11. I got to live with my friend and her mother and her mother's boyfriend and her younger sister. And we had all lived in Eugene, Oregon together, kind of, you know, hippie town USA. And then my parents they were graduate students when I was young. And then they both got like postdocs in San Francisco. So we moved there. And my friend, my best friend Zoe, her mom was an artist in Eugene, and she and her boyfriend both got jobs working for Donald Judd in New York City. And so they moved there into like a studio apartment for people. Hmm. And then I got to come and stay with them for the summer. And it was a huge education for me, being there with them. And it's different to render a novel from the perspective of a young woman who's in her early 20s. That's totally something else other than an 11-year-old. And yet the flavor and mood and kind of spirit of the place, because I was exposed to it, that was already there, forming for me a kind of interest in revisiting it and applying to it my own understanding of what it's like to move to New York City. And for me, that was in the 90s. I mean, I tried to move there like in 1991, and I lived on Clinton Street. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any skills. I was trying to get a job as a bartender. That was my only skill. I didn't have any connections in that world. It was, you know, it was hard. And so I had to move back to San Francisco, which is like a much more provincial world. And then I moved back to New York. And so that, like, my experience of it is kind of secretly refracted through the book. In terms of people, like you mentioned Ben Morea, who you've had on the show. And I could say specifically something about that, maybe. That phenomenon of him and up against the wall, motherfucker, I had never heard about those people. And like living in the New York in the late 90s, early 2000s, I met a lot of artists, and a lot of artists who had like kind of come of age in the 1970s and were still, you know, still mattered, and the discourse that they created in the 70s still mattered. And so I acquired whatever understanding I have was acquired kind of organically, socially. And I would be somewhere and somebody would be telling me, like through my cousin Tovey, who had this storefront space on Avenue B. He was friends with this guy, Michael Keane, who did some contracting for me in my apartment, which was falling apart. And he would tell me about being friends with Teching Xie, the performance artist who tied himself by, I think, 7 feet of rope to the feminist performance artist Linda Montano. And they lived that way for a year.
Wow.
And yeah, and apparently by the time the rope was cut, they didn't say one word to each other and then just turned off and walked. Oh,
wow. And actually, I can imagine.
Like Teching lived for a year, and my cousin Toby was friends with him too. He lived for a year outside. That was one of his art projects. And like he didn't go into any built structures, and you know, he was sleeping on construction scaffoldings, and like he was robbed of all his stuff twice. People shot at him. And so like hear these stories, and I thought this is part of the art too, both the performance itself, where life and art are very much collapsed together so that they can't really be separated or disarticulated. And also the performance of the person who's telling this story. Like, I really love the form of the monologue. Mm. And so recreating those in the novel was my way of paying homage to being young and sitting and listening and seeing people perform things that are like, sometimes people talk about art that's made of fragile materials like wax or feathers, like Robert Rauschenberg or something. And the tall tale is the most fragile material because it dissipates into the air at the end of the night. And so the book was a way to try to crystallize and remake some of that. So in my own experiences, nobody ever brought up the motherfuckers. And I only learned about them through my husband, Jason, who's been on the show. And
friend of the show. He's our political economy correspondent.
He is also my political economy.
Which
is ironic. I actually studied political economy, but, you know, like 35 years ago, what do I know?
He is prolific, though. Let's give him that.
He's my auxiliary brain.
everyone needs one.
Well, yeah, fiction writers go for a more, they're more fast and loose in their style of assimilation. But Jason came back from New York one year, could it have been 2011? And Ben Maria had just come up.
Emerged. I remember emerged. When he emerged. Like, I think Andy and I were at the scene when he emerged. I think the first.
Pushed open a manhole cover.
Yeah, seriously.
He had. Wearing a 10-gallon black cowboy hat.
Hey, literally, like if I know the story correctly, he was in physical danger from dark forces of the deep state and others, perhaps some racketeers and whatnot. And he went and to survive, he went to go live on an Indian reservation for 20 something years. And then you're right. It was 2008, 2009. He reappeared. And some of Andy and my dear friends, like Jacob Blumenfeld, helped him to kind of reemerge by putting him in the small public speaking engagements. And we went to a loft in Hell's Kitchen and listened to his wonderful stories that were just this, you know, really pulling us back to an era that we felt we connected to, being part of this particular scene, feeling a continuity, you know, between these things. Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just have so much to talk about Creation Lake. So let's jump from Flamethrowers to the new book. What sort of research did you do for this project? Did you visit Tarnac, for example, or any of the rural land struggles in France, like the Zone au Defendre or ZAD outside of Nantes? Sorry for my French. I don't know. I do not know how to pronounce French words.
Nanterre. Okay. But I don't have good French pronunciation, and I only started learning French 3 years ago, which has not been an easy project. But
I worked on a French restaurant on the Lower East Side in the early aughts, so my French is all like, "Are you finished with the table? Like, can I get you some more beer?" So I'm with you on that.
I do want to come back to the Ben Maria thing, if you don't mind, eventually. But so. I have this like strange allergy to the concept of research, even as I probably do some research, but the word, I don't even know if you use that word.
I did. I hope that's okay.
No, it's fine. It's good to talk about these things. So it, maybe the reason I hesitate when I hear it is because I fear that it sounds like homework or something. Mm. And like writing novels is never feels like homework. But it's also that there's maybe like it puts into reverse order the way in which ideas and images and scenes and enough of an understanding of the warp and weft of the real world to reproduce one in a book, like how that all comes down, how that, you know, comes into my mind in order to make a novel. It's not like I'm like, oh, I want to write a novel about X. Let's go find out about X so we can do it. I have done, you know, things that are more straight up research. Like I just spent the last 8 months researching the world of nostalgia drag racing because I want to write like a nonfiction reported piece about it. And I spent my whole summer doing that. And it's like 11,000 words. And so I had to immerse myself in a world of intricate expertise that I myself do not at all possess. But in the case of Creation Lake, and maybe all of my novels, with the exception of the first one, which I very much had to research, because Telex from Cuba is about like a moment in 20th century history when all of these countries decolonized, and like my own mother and her sisters had spent a critical part of their childhood in Cuba. And I came to understand that the little quasi-colonial enclave where they lived had a direct role to play in the revolution, because Fidel and Raul Castro grew up literally in the shadow of that enclave. And I thought, oh, this would make for an amazing novel. But it's a world, a milieu, a time, a baroque set of political circumstances that I didn't myself experience in any way. Whereas with the other books, there's room for me inside of them, whether explicitly or more like in a coded manner. And with Creation Lake, I have been going to rural France now for 15 or 16 years. Started going originally to the Corrèze to visit with Jason, to visit a French novelist, good friend of ours, who lives in this little village in southern Corrèze. And that was, you know, at a time when, I guess, well, eventually, you know, Taranak formed, and it's in the Northern Karez. And I knew about them and about Julian through Jason, who had lived in Paris when a much earlier iteration of people were making the original journal called Tycoon.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason had co-translated one of their books with his friend Alex Galloway, Introduction to Civil War. And we had had the zine together called Soft Targets with two poets where some excerpts from his translation appeared. And I mean, how to reconstruct all this? So he knew Julian, and he came to visit us once where we stay in this area of the Valley of Man, as it's called.
Evocative.
Yeah, I know. it's like Priest Valley, Valley of Man.
Yes, yeah. But,
he came there to visit, and we went to Taranak. You know, but the book is not about Taranak. There are, as you mentioned, these other milieu and sites of resistance that are even more famous in France. Like the ZAD, I did not visit. And I will confess rather that I read what I think is the rather excellent book that Verso published of oral histories of the ZAD and the No TAV movement in the Sousa Valley. It's like Christian Ross wrote the introduction. And you read people talking about what they say comes to seem like an account of why things. Do you want to explain the ZAD really quickly for people who are not familiar with this movement?
Yeah, sure. So I know that there were several ones, but the really well known one was outside Nanterre, where they were building an airport, and there was a land reclamation there that was, you know, people involved in the Tycoon milieu were a part of, but also a lot of other local people and anarchists, and they essentially—I haven't been there myself, so yeah, I've only known about it from reading about it. But it sounds like this land reclamation project became so large that they sort of set up their own autonomous village there in the woods to block the construction of the airport that still exists to this day in some form, and the airport was never built. And one thing I was really fascinated about is that part of it was ecological, you know, we want to save this forest, but part of it was also like the No TAV struggle. It was, well, we actually don't think we need more airports. We want less airports. Mm. We don't think we need to go from Paris to Milan in 2 hours by train. This is actually not the world we believe in. And I thought that was a very different frame of struggle than simply like save the trees.
Mm. There was a civilizational argument behind it.
Yeah, I think what interested me about the ZAD is that it becomes this sudden context for many different kinds of people to come together and form a set of collective demands that are not prescribed demands, so that everybody has to be of exactly the same sort of political, social, cultural disposition. Like a lot of the photos that you look at, it's like there are farmers bringing sheep into the courtroom, and a lot of clergy got involved. And that's the part that seems most interesting to me, is that it's not just like anarchist kids from cities showing up, you know, to bring a sort of militant element to things. I mean, there's a role for that, but there seemed to be something about the occasion that had that magical blend to it. When you think historically about, you know, these occasions when people come together, like the students and the workers in 68, I mean, that didn't really shake out the way that some would have hoped. Whereas what happened in the ZAD seems to have been this kind of blend. And then there is the historical precedent of the Larzac, which is a plateau in the Lozère. We have been to that area. It has this feeling to it, to me, of like the time in France of the retreat of the Cathars, the Albigensian people who like went up into the cliffs to hide. There are these tall limestone cliffs in the Lozère, and it's very dramatic and feels very closed. And then there's these open plateaus. And the Larzac, similarly to the Zad, the French state, as I understand it, had plans to expand a military base. And it became in the 1970s for people who were kind of post-68ers who had retreated to the country thinking like, though there's not going to be widespread revolt on the factory floor, it's in fact the peasant class in France that is the true spirit of revolt and goes back hundreds of years to the peasant revolts of the 17th century or even the 13th century, 12th century. These people, like a lot of them, retreated to rural locales to try to forge relationships with farmers and retreat from cities in order to make a new reality where if the terms and conditions of reality at large cannot be transformed, then do it in some groupuscule, in some commune form. And Larzac became such a huge movement and occupation of this land that the state wanted to utilize for a military base. And the sheep farmers and others resisted that Mitterrand, who was president at the time, ended up having to scrap those plans. So these kinds of successes, you know, they take on a sort of greater significance for people later on. And I guess I'm interested in that and in looking at these things and they're there. And then, you know, in terms of like you mentioned the TGV and ecology, I suddenly remembered our son, Remy, he went to this camp in a quite rural area that's sort of between the Department Lot and the Department Dordogne, starting when he was 7. And then the last 2 summers he worked at that camp as a counselor. And it's a very sort of like seat of the pants, hippie, informal place. Like once he saw, you know, how the operation was run, his opinions about it changed a little bit. Like they would send him to the market, you know, buy only expired meat out of the bag. and kids get injured there every day. So this area of France is completely subtended by caves and cave structures. And there are the famous caves like Lascaux and Chauvet. Chauvet is further south. Lascaux is in the Dordogne, and it's in the region that we know quite well. But there are many, many caves that don't have art in them per se. They might have some resistance graffiti in them that Remy goes into, and they might be on a farmer's property with a metal grate and a key, or there's just like literally a manhole cover on the side of the road. And the people who know about them, once you start to know they're there, then this world opens and opens and opens and expands. And so Remy knows that underground world through this camp, because it's one of the things they do is go in caves. And sometimes they're going through very cold water that's neck deep for like a long ways underground. They have to wear wetsuits. They wear headlamps. He told me he goes through areas that are crevices you have to kind of shimmy through for 45 minutes to an hour, so narrow that you cannot turn your head.
Nope. I would never, ever do that.
I can't imagine doing that. And so some of the material in my book that Bruno talks about is I have access to that only through my son. He did go into a cave like I described, which
cool.
The walls were sparkling white, like freshly fallen snow. And he said it's magnesium crystals that form. And it was even more dramatic than how I described it after he read the description in the book. And he said, well, it was actually taller. It was 60 meters, like an enormous cathedral, but very narrow. And one of his earliest experiences in the caves, he was following their leader. It's this guy, he lives in the country. He works, I think, in the winter for the French state doing some kind of hydrology. His name is Jean-Paul, and JP, as they call him. And they were in the cave. I should say, like, Remy, luckily for him, speaks French. which is why he was able to go to and then work at this camp. It's French kids and it's rural French kids. Like their dads work for the fire department or sell tractors or whatever. And they were in this cave and Remy said he felt this shaking. And then he was a 7 or 8 year old kid. And then he said he felt wind on his face. And he said to Juppé, like, what is it? And Juppé said, it's the Paris-Toulouse train.
Oh.
And so then you think about
shaking the earth.
Yeah, that the incursions of the state and industry into this underground world that otherwise holds within it maybe the sedimented layers of the history of people and the history of the earth. And the way that water itself is stored there, it's like the most ingenious storage facility. It keeps the water cool, filters it, and makes it clean, and there it is for us. And suddenly the state is wanting to suck out all that water and put it into these plastic lined open bays where it can leach poisons and be evaporated by the sun. And more importantly, monopolized by the industries the state decides should have the easiest and least expensive access, and taking that water away from the water table where farmers, you know, or anyone could use it. So there was some of that involved in terms of the inspiration, but there's like no one-to-one relationship with Tarnac or Julian or those people, because that's like, that's a specific history. And he is a very particular person and has like a style of speech. I don't even know. In fact, I do know that I would not be able to emulate him, but nor would I be motivated to do it, because none of my novels, and maybe especially this one, are meant to be about real people.
Can I read a passage from your book?
Yeah,
is that weird or good?
Okay. No.
I'll read a passage. I mean, I guess, you know, you should probably be the one reading it, but I found this really, really evocative. And I feel like, you know, your book, almost like rural France, is almost like a character. It's certainly the environment, like the milieu that things are in. And as you said earlier, this is all prelude to reading the passage. There's something about France, you know, there's something about France in the American imagination, Paris in the American imagination, but like you try to get away from that. France has this ability for Narodnik type groups, like you mentioned earlier, anarchist types from the city, to be able to go into the country and find some sort of popular base that has the ability to have a yellow vest movement, you know, one that's not reactionary in the countryside. Let's read this passage here and see what it says. This is the protagonist is at a truck stop and finds some orange high-vis underwear hanging in a tree. The real Europe is a borderless network of supply and transport. It is shrink-wrapped pallets of super-pasteurized milk or powdered Nesquik or semiconductors. The real Europe is highways and nuclear power plants. It is windowless distribution warehouses where unseen men, Polish, Moldavian, Macedonian, back up their empty trucks and load goods that they will move through a giant grid called Europe, a Texas-sized parcel of which is called France. These men will ignore weight regulations on their loads and safety inspections on their brakes. They will text someone at home in their ethno-national language, listen to pop music in English, and get their needs met locally in empty parking lots on mountain passes. The only mystery is where they find the women for these occasions, but even that isn't so hard to imagine. A girl or woman fallen on hard times, not French, and without EU documents, stuck in a rural outpost, picking her way out of the main road in impractical high-heeled shoes, a flesh-biting imitation leather, aloe in her purse for rapid-fire hand jobs. She has left her underwear in these woods. Big deal. Her world is full of disposability. The panties hanging on a bush in front of my face are a package of three or five euros at a Carrefour. They're like Kleenex. You sweat or leak or bleed into them and then toss them on the bush or in the trash, or you flush them and clog the plumbing, somebody else's plumbing, ideally. This is like an entryway into like a Europe, into a France that I think for the reader and certainly myself, it's an entryway into class, into the built environment, into gender, into exploitation and into oppression that I think is really evocative in this book. Like, I'm not going to ask you where the research came from this, but what's your inspiration for this look, this look into Europe and France in the rural areas?
Yeah, no research to come up with that. It's just, you know, I go there a lot, and you take these auto routes. They're built by the EU, I believe. These are huge state projects that are EU projects. And you see those dudes on the side of the highway wearing like state worker pants that have this band of reflective material around the cuff.
Oh, I've seen them. Yeah.
And then some part of me thinks, oh, that's the real Europe, you know, are these guys. So a lot of it is just observation. I think those underwear, she's probably exaggerating about how cheap they are. They're a little more expensive at Carrefour, but this narrator, you know, tells the reader that her and tells the milieu of people she means harm by, that her name is Sadie. We don't know her real name. I'll just call her Sadie for the sake of efficiency. This is her read and her perspective. And I take things I've seen and picked up. You know, things go into you without much filtering, I should say. Like, one absorbs things over the course of the day, the week, the year. And then when I'm writing fiction, they come back to me. And it's like I'm able to revisit all that I collected without my conscious sorting mechanism. And then I can have these encounters with images that I absorbed and apparently stored. And she speaks in a voice that is not at all mine. Mm. And she gives a view that is fairly cynical, but also kind of seems true on some level. And I could make an argument for or agree with what she's saying. At the same time, I have the luxury of creating another character who's kind of like her opposite. And the book is really about the relationship between the two of them. Bruno is kind of much more like, he's very tender to me. He's a very gentle person. Like, and I mean gentle in like a kind of deep way. I'm interested in that kind of gentleness. And he has sort of mystical ideas about making a reality that is in some sense characterized by good, dare I say it. But so Sadie is almost like, she's like a kind of devil in a way.
An antagonist, not a protagonist.
Yeah, to me. And I was thinking about that in terms of what I was going to say to both of you, because I knew that, or speculated that, you would have read this book and seen scenes and milieu and drifts, tones that are somewhat familiar from real worlds that matter to people.
Yes.
And there she is going in with a kind of malicious intent, meaning harm by these people. She is a cop and a narc. Mm-hmm. And why? I think that knowing enough about these milieu to render one in a way that seems, if it does seem believable, means that I have been granted access at some point or another to that world or these worlds. And the very gesture of taking what I've absorbed, having been granted that access, one could argue that it's like a profound betrayal to put that into a book. But I believe in fiction. And since the fiction is about things that concern me, namely who we are, where we've been, and where we're going, I'm unhindered by the idea that it's not cool to use the details because it's only for those who were there. But rather, I started to think about betrayal itself, and I decided to make her uniformly a betrayer. And I think I was also thinking about this question of the cop, because there was one who was very much on the scene, and, you know, his name was Mark Stone / Mark Kennedy. And as you probably know, you know, he was associated with and surveilling like some people that some of us know.
Mm-hmm.
And behaving badly didn't seem all that shrewd or canny in his methods and strategies, sleeping with a lot of different women in these leftist scenes in, from what I understand, you know, Germany and England and also France. And then was busted by a bunch of people who, from what I was told, kind of surrounded him and called him out. Like, why do you have 9 passports in your glove box? And from what I heard, he, you know, he cried and he said, it's you guys that I'm really with. And he may have felt that in that moment, but then later on retreated back to the zone of betrayal and then disappeared into the private sector. And I think he was working for whatever Blackwater renamed itself. He was working for those people. And then there were a bunch of articles that appeared about him, and also that guy Bob Lambert, who had a child with a woman in a movement, and the child sued the state for having a father who was a fictitious person. As like, this is all ripe for fiction. It's like so deep and worth thinking about. And the guys who had written the series of Guardian articles about Mark Kennedy then turned it into a book. I mean, the Guardian to me is like the Daily Mail. It's a tabloid paper or tabloid pieces, but there's a part of me that like has a taste for the fait divers, the tabloid story. But I was interested in the Mark Kennedy thing because it was a bit close to home in terms of my own like social world, my real private life. And I happened to run into the two guys who wrote that book at a literary festival in Edinburgh, Scotland. And I went to their event and I hadn't read the book yet. I don't think it had just come out. And so it was like one of their first events. And I approached them afterward and said, did you guys talk to Mark Kennedy? And it turned out, no, you know, they had no access to him because he had just disappeared into this world. And then there was this woman who worked for the FBI who entrapped Eric McDavid, who then served, you know, 9 of 20 years. And I guess, you know, what kind of person would do this sort of thing?
Yeah,
is one question. And Sadie is not based on any of those people. But to go in from the perspective of a devil, I don't know. It's like, so that was, in a sense, the mission with her. And so when she's describing Europe, she is borrowing certain things from me. I mean, she, you know, she takes a piss in the woods and encounters these underpants in front of her face and later declares that scene to be, you know, the tomb of the unknown hooker. Mm-hmm. And I guess like that's me and my sense of humor. But in other ways, her perspective on this world that she arrives to is largely 180 degrees from my own. And I still don't entirely know like what that betrayal means, but I thought more about it after. I'm sorry, name drop here, but I got this letter from Frederick Jameson, and he said, you know, it's the mist of betrayal that you know, hovers over the novel is very interesting to me. And so sometimes you write a novel and you have to think later about what all of that means.
Yeah, I this is exactly what I found so engrossing when I started reading the book, is it seeing this milieu through the eyes of an agent provocateur who is so odious, you know, obviously the most hated person you could have on the revolutionary left. And, you know, also it hit close home to me because I knew Eric McDavid and I was around when that all went down. But it also, it hit close home to me because I felt like the character Sadie learning about this milieu reminded me of, because I've never been to Taranak, I've never met Julian Coupat, but I'm very interested in it and I read everything I can read about it, even, you know, the drama, the denunciations, like I want to know about it. And that's kind of cop-like behavior. Like, that stuff is nothing.
Like a tabloid behavior,
it's
too.
Like, you none like of my the tabloids, business, really.
I get the Daily News sometimes myself.
And then there's another level of that where I'm reading the book and I'm like, well, who's this character? Who's this character? Like, is that someone I know? And so, like, the Bruno Lacombe character, for example, reminds me a lot of Jacques Camat. And I was very interested in, maybe shifting gears a bit, if that's all right. I was very interested in this his theory of the Neanderthal ancestry of certain ethnic groups, or like a spiritual ancestry of humanity, and theorizing that as a kind of revolutionary subject in a way, as part of this fetishization of peasant life that the characters have. And on Instagram recently, you posted two books that I think served as an inspiration for this theory by the Soviet historian Boris Porchev about the connection between Neanderthals and humans, and the one of them's called The Soviet Sasquatch. So how did you get interested in Porchev?
Oh, yeah. Porchev, right? Porchev. So, yeah. I mean, for us, the Jacques Camus reference is quite obvious, even as, I guess, to most people, he would be a fairly obscure figure. But Bruno is not based on Camus. I don't know enough about Camus and his personal life and his history.
Hey, everybody. If you want to hear the rest of our conversation with Rachel Kushner, please go to patreon.com/theantifada. Sean and I were just too excited about this episode to paywall the episode, so it's just sitting there for free. But while you're there, if you'd like to support the show, please sign up for $5 or $10 a month. Or what we really appreciate is if you pay for the year in advance, you get a 17% discount when you do. And no matter how you sign up, you get access to all of our bonus material, our back catalog, and our Discord community, where you can talk about the episodes and join the book club. And we have a lot of our frequent guests active on there as well. So again, that's patreon.com/theantifada. Thanks for listening.
What is this, some fear?